Will, a while ago you wrote a blog post called Malaise, where you were talking about the state of the film industry. And you were telling me before we started recording that you're working on another piece about all the summer's greatest hits or something like that.
Well, you know, I just like to go to the movies and pop some corn and, you know, shovel a big soda into my disgusting face and sit back and enjoy and turn the brain off, you know, take the on-off switch, turn it to the off and enjoy some spectacle. And yeah, you know, people who don't know me intimately may not know that I was once a weekly film critic.
Mm-hmm. And you were the student, our old student newspaper, The Varsity. You were briefly the designated film critic, which, as I understand it, was a role created specifically for you.
I think they felt bad about not giving me associate arts editor that year. So
it was a role that I was briefly very jealous of. You may be interested to know.
Well,
I was like, this guy has a title. I don't have anything.
Yeah, I got to go see The Dark Knight 5 days before everyone else.
Was that the one that you described as having Oscar buzz?
I think I used that phraseology for a lot of movies. You know, my ancient review of No Country for Old Men is an embarrassment.
Well, see, you know, as your editor during your year as arts editor, you know, I really admired, I think probably still admire, I haven't read them for a while, but I think you wrote some really great pieces. And I was surprised to hear you were saying you're trying to kind of you know, experiment a little bit more as a writer, and you're writing a kind of follow-up blog post to this Malaise one that you did recently. But you were saying that year, which I guess was 2010, 2011, you did a lot of prose experiments. Now, I thought these worked out rather well, but you sounded a little bit diffident about
it. Yeah, you know, when I was 20, 21, 22, I kept thinking, well, you know, I'm a genius. You know, I'm like my heroes, Hunter S. Thompson and Tom Wolfe. I'll reinvent the form. All these conventional minds who are writing articles don't have it figured out. And so I'm going to bring cubism to magazine articles.
Uh-huh.
And of course, you know, I was young and arrogant and didn't realize that people had already done this before. You know, I like some of the stuff I wrote for our student newspaper, but the prose experiment side of it, the prose poem side of it, I sort of see it now as like a smoke and mirrors for not being intellectually rigorous.
Uh-huh.
It's like you can, it's like a shortcut. It looks innovative to hide the fact that you can't fully come up with and synthesize your own thoughts, you know?
We've talked about, you know, the writing we did as student journalists before on this podcast. And one of the things that I think we agreed on was that a characteristic of the bad writing that we all do and have done, particularly in our early 20s, is, you know, it's very derivative, right? It's all we have is that we can draw on the things that the last thing we read. You know, I remember going through a phase as a teenager where, you know, in English class, anything I wrote would just be like exactly like it would be a bad attempt to copy whatever the last thing I'd read was.
I mean, what's funny is when you're a teenager or you're in your early 20s, you're discovering a lot of very popular things for the first time.
Uh-huh.
So you feel like, God, I'm like the first guy who's ever read Hunter S. Thompson.
A book that's existed for 50 or 75 or 250 years, you receive it as a new vista of possibility that no one else has ever, you know, encountered.
And
you're just unearthing it and, you know, unmasking its revelations to the to the world. But what you're saying sounds like something a little different. It's not that you felt that, you know, the stuff you did in those days was derivative exactly. It was that you were trying to be experimental in a way which maybe it was successful on the level of prose, but wasn't intellectually innovative. Do I understand?
I think that's the case. You remember there was one time when I think you ran into me in the library at one point and I said, oh, I'm trying to write something more academic.
Uh-huh. I do remember that. You were writing about B-movies.
Something. Yeah. And like, that seemed like a very radical thing at the time. And I didn't get very far with it because I don't think I quite had the firepower to write something academic at the time. And like, it's one thing to sort of dazzle with a lot of gimmickry and a lot of experimentation, but it's another to actually have an interesting thing to say and to just fucking say it, you know, say it in plain English. So I think in some respects, my taste in writing has become a little more conservative.
Uh-huh.
I like somebody who says what they mean.
This is digressing from what we're actually talking about, but now that Will's brought it up, I do remember that because I remember that summer very well. We'd both taken on our new roles at the Varsity. Will was co-arts editor, I was editor-in-chief, but we didn't really have anything to do because we produced I think, only two issues, you know, over the summer. In the summer, this is summer in the undergraduate sense, which means it's like 4.5 months long. So it's, yeah, it's almost half the year. And Will and I were both in summer school, and we were in this horror film class.
That's
right. I'm sure you remember this.
Cass Banning taught it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Professor Cass Banning.
Shout out.
And we watched things like The Thing. Mm-hmm. We watched...
Dawn of the Dead, was that in there?
Let the Right One In.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah. Yeah.
If people haven't seen that, that's a... There's a remake, a North American remake called Let Me In, but watch the original. Is it a date? No, Norwegian?
I can't remember what country it is.
It's a Scandinavian.
It's quite good. Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
And it's also where you picked up one of your favorite frameworks that you still bring up to this day, which I think you wrote a paper on, which is, you know, one horror film that was progressive and one that was reactionary.
Yeah, that's Robin Wood, the famed Toronto film theorist.
Uh-huh. Is he still alive?
No, he passed away about 10 years ago. But yeah, he's the author of Hollywood from Vietnam to Reagan. And
great book.
Well worth looking into.
A book Will introduced me to, which is really fantastic.
And yeah, we would watch a horror movie in the class, then we'd go to the varsity office and probably watch some like shitty TV.
And probably drink way too much and stay up really late because we were
young and
nothing had any consequences in those days.
Yeah, that was fun, wasn't it?
Anyway, our conversation before the pod about writing in our early 20s. Eventually turned to writing that inspired us, because the flip side of being derivative is that you're actually often finding things that really change the way you look at the world, change how you think about the craft of writing. So I was asking Will about, you know, is there particular prose, is there particular writing that kind of changed things for you? And there was a passage from Jonathan Rosenbaum that you brought up, which really is quite breathtaking. Maybe listeners who are not writers won't have quite had this experience, although I'm sure you've had something analogous to it, but certainly as both a reader and a writer, I often find there are just particular passages that stick in my mind, and it may not always be even because of what they're saying in particular. Sometimes it's more about often it's more about how something is being said. Transforming and evolving as a writer often has a lot to do with understanding new ways to convey ideas. And one of the things that really good prose can do is it can teach you that, because it's basically giving you a live demonstration. So, you know, you were saying one of your frustrations in that summer we were taking the horror film course and spending too much time at the varsity office, you were trying to write, you know, an academic essay about B-movies, and you weren't quite sure how to do that. You didn't get very far.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure part of surpassing that hurdle as a writer probably owes itself to reading good prose. And there's probably something that stuck in, and I was asking you, you know, is there something that stuck in your head that did that for you? And you had this passage from Jonathan Rosenbaum, which was so good, I thought we should read it on the show.
This comes from an article called Declaration of Independence. That's ENTS, a review of Hardly Working, the Jerry Lewis movie. This was written in 1981 for the Soho News, and it's reproduced in Rosenbaum's excellent book, Placing Movies. And the opening paragraph goes, "My dream scenario runs roughly like this. J.D. Salinger finally relents and allows Jerry Lewis to direct a film based on The Catcher in the Rye. Salinger's sister told me if anyone could get it from him, it would be me," Lewis remarked in a 1977 interview, "and civilization as we know it collapses. In the ensuing sociocultural upheaval occasioned by this deconstruction of two critical reputations, anarchy reigns supreme. Mad dogs roam the street. The New Yorker shrivels to a cinder out of acute, well-mannered embarrassment. And all those distinguished gray eminences in my profession who fear and loathe Lewis for what he says about their own bodies and social discomforts, some of whom shrink in terror from Jacques Tati for the same reasons, run screaming off to the Hamptons and Berkshires to write their own fiction, never to return." I mean, you know, the rest of the article is great too, but that paragraph in particular, I mean, not only the beautiful prose of it, but what it says about the ideology of good taste.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult to talk about taste without coming across as either anti-intellectual or snobby.
Mm-hmm.
To say that the hierarchies of taste are arbitrary, but also having sort of a politics behind that statement.
Mm-hmm. Well, because without a politics, that's just a statement of pure relativism.
Exactly.
It's like,
yeah,
everything is just subjective.
Yeah.
So there's no basis for any kind of aesthetic make judgment at all. You can't say something is good. You can only say it's good to me.
Yeah. So like what's behind that?
And this is why, by the way, I'm right about Andy Warhol and you're wrong.
Well, anyway, sorry, okay. Continue. Well, I'm sure we'll return to that on a future episode. But behind that, he's not just saying that, oh, Jerry Lewis is great. And this is, and you people are stupid because you're snobs. He's saying Jerry Lewis is great because he's telling you truths that you don't want to hear. And he's telling truths that are not fashionable in polite middle-class society. Now, whether or not you agree with that idea, mm-hmm. like that's the politics undergirding the paragraph.
And it makes sense to me why this would have been kind of revelatory to you, given, you know, kind of how I understand your experience with film criticism, because I didn't really start actually reading Roger Ebert until just a few years ago. And I read him almost as, you know, he's a reference, just a basic reference for me. I have his books, The Great Movies, just for, if I'm going to watch something from the canon, it's like, all right, Ebert's useful because he gives you the normie take on something that's nevertheless, you know, appreciative and puts it in context.
Yeah, whereas for me, he was somebody that I grew up watching on TV. Mm-hmm. You know, he was like an early reference point for me. And one of his appeals to me was that he was the normiest guy. He was like the lib, sensible, you know, middle-class guy uh-huh. who can give you the correct opinion.
He's going to give you the sort of axiologically neutral take on the canon.
And Ebert will occasionally do a review where it's challenging conventional wisdom or purporting to question the hierarchies of taste or whatever, but he always couches it in these very relativistic terms. So it's like, for what it's trying to do, Reanimator is a good movie. 3 stars. Obviously, it's not as good as American Beauty.
Casablanca.
Yeah. Yeah. But for what it's trying to do, and that framing is very conservative, uh-huh. you know?
And so it was later that you discovered, you know, your Jonathan Rosenbaums, your yeah. Robin Woods, your Jay Hobermans.
Sure, sure.
Well, my revelatory paragraph, obviously, is from a piece of political writing rather than film writing. But I think it had the same effect on me that Will describes reading this passage of Jonathan Rosenbaum's. Anyone who's familiar at all with my written work or who's just listened to this podcast will know that a big part of what I do and a lot of what I spend my time thinking about is critiquing liberalism from the left. So some years ago, I discovered Irving Howe, who's one of the great American essayists of the 20th century, also played a role in the founding of the Democratic Socialists of America and Dissent magazine. And a few years ago, a book of his essays came out, and Dissent published a number of his most famous essays, including one called This Age of Conformity. It's from 1954. And the following two paragraphs have stuck in my brain ever since the first time I encountered them. In fact, I actually encountered them as a kind of an excerpt, you know, a kind of bolded, highlighted, enlarged excerpt, completely devoid of their actual context in the essay. And they were nevertheless just as powerful. In fact, and maybe they were powerful precisely because of that. So Howe writes, "This prevalence of liberalism yields, to be sure, some obvious and substantial benefits. It makes us properly skeptical of the excessive claims and fanaticisms that accompany ideologies. It makes implausible those aristocratic rantings against democracy, which were fashionable in some literary circles a few years ago. And it allows for the hope that any revival of American radicalism will acknowledge not only its break from, but also its roots in the liberal tradition. At the same time, however, the dominance of liberalism contributes heavily to our intellectual conformity. Liberalism dominates, but without confidence or security. It knows that its victories at home are tied to disasters abroad. And for the elan it cannot summon, it substitutes a blend of complacence and anxiety. It makes for an atmosphere of blur in the realm of ideas, since it has a stake in seeing momentary concurrences as deep harmonies. In an age that suffers from incredible catastrophes, it scoffs at theories of social apocalypse, as if any more evidence were needed. In an era convulsed by war, revolution, and counter-revolution, it discovers the virtue of moderation."
It sounds like it was written yesterday.
Yeah, I think it stuck with me because it has a kind of a universalism to it. It seems to almost transcend space and time, though it was written in the early 1950s. As a piece of prose writing, it's incredible. Just, you know, aesthetically, every beat, every comma and semicolon is in the right place. Every word is perfectly chosen. And I think it was a combination of these two things that made that kind of stick with me so much. I'm probably exaggerating the extent to which this particular passage has had an influence on me as a writer. But I do think it's significant that after all these years, I still remember this and it sticks with me so much.
Where were you on your sort of intellectual journey when you that's a very pretentious phrase, isn't it? But
sorry, you interviewing me for the London Review of Books?
But were you, say, as radical as you are now when you read that? And like, what was it that brought you to that? Was it the ideas or the prose?
I think it was a number of things. I think, for one, it was I'd never seen these ideas conveyed in quite this way. Mm. The strength of this passage is, I think, demonstrated by the fact that we read it now and it sounds like it could have been written yesterday. Mm-hmm. And that's partly because it's so stylistically strong, but also because of what it's conveying. But, you know, my entry point into politics was political science. You know, it was kind of an academic route, and I was also kind of an activist at the time, like a party activist. I was working on campaigns and things like that. So I'm not sure that I'd seen left-wing politics anyway discussed in this level of abstraction, and in a way which seemed so kind of personal but also so universally applicable. Mm-hmm. That's really not a perfect answer on my part, but I'm not actually sure why this particular passage had such a profound effect on me.
To mention another film critic, Pauline Kael, who I'm not really a big fan of, but
whatever, at least she has opinions. I would take her over any like generic newspaper film critic these days.
When I say that I'm not a big fan of her, it's like, it's one thing to say you're not a big fan of some hack, but when you say you're not a big fan of like an original thinker and a great prose stylist.
Well, it's just you disagree with her.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, I'm not a big fan of her at a much higher level. But, you know, when I discovered her very young, one of the revelations of her was that criticism could be beautiful. Like, mm-hmm. criticism could be an art form in and of itself. And honestly, that passage you read sounds kind of like that. Like, one doesn't think of political writing or theory as an art form, mm-hmm. you know?
When I was pretty used to reading things like Chomsky, who, you know, Chomsky's not a bad writer, you know, by any means, but if you're reading, it, like I was, his kind of books from the 90s and the 2000s, you know, what you have is kind of very clinical kind of summaries of various, you know, depredations of the American empire, media mm-hmm. hypocrisy, things like that. Doesn't lend itself to the same kind of almost breathtaking prose. And I think perhaps it may really be as superficial as that. I found mm-hmm. the prose so incredible. I didn't realize these ideas could be conveyed this way. And maybe that's why the passage has stuck with me.
Got a library card.